The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
The internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's a series of tubes.
A series of tubes. That is our regular run-through of the latest tech stories with Rob Fleischman. He's principal engineer at Akamai Technologies and our chief explainer of all things Wired. Hello, Rob.
Hey, Virginia. Great to be here again.
Really great to have you. And we're starting out today with tech mergers. AT&T has plans to purchase Time Warner. Now, the FCC chair says he does not plan to review the merger. So what's happening there? What does it mean for consumers?
Oh, my goodness. So, you know, there's really two areas of the government that are involved in these mergers, right? So there's the Department of Justice, which gets involved in everything, and the FCC, which really only gets involved when it has to do with broadcast licenses. So what's interesting here is AT&T, which, of course, is a large telecommunication provider of all types, right? Wireless, wireline. But the Time Warner they're talking about is the content side, right? So it's all movies, television, that sort of stuff. Content.
And the distinction there is it's not the pipes that
That's right.
It's not the series of tubes that brings
That's
the
right. So if you remember, if we're trying to remember back, last year Charter and Time Warner Cable merged, right? And now there's this, and that, of course, had a lot to do with the FCC and broadcast licenses. And now we're talking about Verizon maybe merging with Charter and Sprint buying T-Mobile and more mergers. And, you know, I don't know how well those are going to go with the DOJ. I know Trump is not a favor of some of these mergers. And honestly, as a consumer, you know, more competition is better for us, right? We've done countless segments on how slow the internet is and how few choices we have for communications.
So this represents a greater monopolization or fewer players in the internet, broadband, and content areas.
You got it. That's exactly right.
So why would the FCC not review that?
Well, I mean, like I said, they're all about broadcast licenses. You know, if NHPR wants to buy someone who paints pictures, they're not going to have anything to do with that. But if NHPR wants to buy another radio station that has broadcast licenses, well, the FCC is going to look at that.
Okay. Let's move on to the next subject, which is smartphone fatigue. TechCrunch reported that one of the coolest new phones being showcased at Mobile World Congress was a throwback to the early 2000s, the
right.
Nokia 3310. That's a flip phone, right?
Right. Well, it's a small phone, right? So it's not a smartphone, you know. So the 3310 and 3390. So if we rewind the clock back, you know, they sold 130 million of these phones. I had one, had the little snake game, and, you know, it was really, you know, it did a teeny bit of texting maybe, but it was mostly just, you know, accepting calls. So a couple things going on here. First, nostalgia. Second, boy, I remember this Nokia phone, and the best thing about it was the battery lasted forever. I mean, you know, you got this phone and you recharged it once a week. It was amazing. Right now,
right,
your smartphone, you're charging it every night, if you're lucky, right? Maybe more. So there's a bit of nostalgia there. And there's also this whole movement of, okay, it's the weekend. Maybe this is my weekend phone, right? I'm not going to do texting. I'm going to cut the cord to some extent. So,
seriously?
Little nostalgia there. You know, I don't know how this is going to play out, but it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool to see the old phones come back.
All right. Well, we'll see how that one plays out.
That's
beyond
right.
The weekend.
Exactly.
Next, we also have a political story that you brought to our attention. New rules about whether ISPs, that's an internet service provider like Comcast and AT&T, can sell your data. So why is this a political story?
Well, what's interesting is, so last year, you know, the Telecommunications Act talked a lot about saying, you know, it's one thing for Facebook and Google and those types of sites that you engage in to use your data. And everyone knows that, right? I mean, Facebook's not really, quote, free, right? I mean, they're using your data, they're using your history, they're advertising to you, et cetera. But your ISP, you know, your Time Warners, your Comcasts, your British Telecoms, you know, however, wherever you are in the world that provide you access, you know, how much of your data are they allowed to use, right? And right now, you need to explicitly opt in. You need to say to them, hey, it is okay for you to use this personal information about me and sell it to others.
I don't remember ever doing that.
That's right. Well, you haven't. So by default, you have not opted in.
Okay. So then it is not okay for them to use my data.
That's correct. So what they're discussing is they're saying, well, maybe we should flip that around. maybe I should be allowed to use Virginia's data, unless he explicitly says to me that I cannot. And that's why it's getting political.
Oh, that is sneaky Pete stuff.
And there's a lot of money here, of course, right? There's a lot of information that your internet provider can gather about you by providing you the service, right? Browsing history, even simple things like usage patterns. What time of day does Virginia use the internet? And where is she going? And what kind of conversations is she having? What apps does she use? All that's very powerful, very interesting information that can be sold.
So who's pushing to sell it?
Well, the internet providers are, right? I mean, it's monetizable.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Big, so big money for them.
Big, big money for them.
And where is it in political terms? Like, has a bill been proposed?
Really just lobbying right now, discussion right now. You know, we have a new administration. It's unclear what direction they're going to go.
It is A Series of Tubes with Rob Fleischman. He's explaining technical things that, well, let's face it, I can't. Okay, Rob, we can't end without the Jurassic Park beat.
That's right.
A story that we read in Gizmodo about de-extinction. Now, what is de-extinction?
Okay, so this professor, I guess, George Church out of Harvard, he's a scientist, is looking at growing woolly mammoths. You know, it's certainly cool genetics, but there's a lot of dollars that would involve bringing back a viable woolly mammoth or any other dinosaur. Wouldn't those dollars be better spent preserving the animals we have that are possibly going extinct?
Okay, point.
I mean, I don't think we're being overrun by elephants, right? There's not exactly a ton of them. Maybe we should put money into preserving them rather than bringing back another type of elephant. So,
okay, I see where you're coming from here.
I think this is an interesting intellectual curiosity, but I doubt it's going to go too far.
All right, but if there were a Triceratops on view, you wouldn't go see it.
I don't know. That does sound fascinating.
Okay. It's time for Explain Things Like I'm 10. This is going to be part of this segment, today's topic, one that is probably going to be pretty much in the news more and more over the next couple of years. This is net neutrality. Now, the Obama administration was for net neutrality. The Trump administration, not so much. So explain to me like I'm 10.
Exactly. So net neutrality, this is a tough one. I had to think a long time about how to make this clear to non-technical people. So here we go. The analogy I would give you is driving on the highway. So we're out for our drive on the highway, and we got six lanes, and there's not a lot of traffic, and we're zipping along in our car just fine, right? So net neutrality would say that where you're going, who you are, what car you're in, you know, what lane you're in, doesn't matter. Everybody drives at the same speed limit. You know, everyone's going to go 65, right? And that makes sense, right? Why should some car be allowed to be in that left lane and not me? Why should some car be allowed to drive 100 miles an hour if they're going to New Jersey, but I'm going to Massachusetts, so I have to drive slower? So, you know, that makes sense. I mean, I think everybody gets it. And when you talk about net neutrality in those terms, everyone's like, hey, yeah, absolutely. When I use the internet, why should Virginia's packets get preference to mine? You know, that doesn't make any sense. So everybody gets that, and that's totally fine. Where things get complicated and technology people like me start scratching our heads about net neutrality is when there's congestion. Okay, so let's go back to our highway analogy. The road's congested now. We're at bumper to bumper. We're all crawling around at 10 miles an hour. And you know what? I see in the rearview mirror an ambulance. Should the ambulance be allowed to pass? Should we all get out of the way for the ambulance?
Well, if it's a life and death situation, sure.
Okay, but in net neutrality, all packets are the same, right? Or what about a police car? Or what about a fire engine? Or maybe even simpler, what about our high occupancy vehicle lane, right? Our HOV lane, where maybe allowing those people to have their own lane encourages people to carpool.
Okay,
right?
So question, is the ambulance in this analogy a Netflix movie?
Well, that's a great question. You know, so let me give you a more interesting analogy.
I think this one is pretty. You're doing a really good job.
Okay, well, I'm doing my best here. So you're watching a Netflix movie. Let's use your example. You're watching a Netflix movie, and it's streaming down to your computer, and it's all looking great. The video is good. The audio is good. It's all matched. It's all wonderful. And the guy next door decides to email his doctoral dissertation with 1,800 attachments, and it's like a monster, monster file. And he's going to email that out, you know, back to his university where he works. Okay? That's great. Well, you two are kind of competing for the same line, right? He's next door to you. So there might be some congestion. So the question is, if we treat all the packets the same, maybe Virginia's movie gets delayed. Maybe she loses some audio. But guess what? This guy was sending an email, right? You were watching a video. Video, latency, delivery, all that's very important. But you know what? If his email arrived half a second later to the university, nobody would know the difference, right? Mm-hmm. But if we delay your video half a second,
people are going to get mad.
Oh, it's going to be a problem, right? What if Virginia happens to be making a voice over IP call, a call over the internet? Maybe it was a 911 call. Maybe it was a really important call, or she's listening to a conference, or she's listening to a podcast. You know, the quality of the audio is really important. If we drop that, she'll have to rewind. People won't get the data. But there are certain other types of information like email or text messages that if we delay them for a very small amount of time, maybe milliseconds, maybe hundreds of milliseconds, something that a human wouldn't even notice, right? We could preserve the quality of service for other people when things are congested. So that's where network neutrality gets a little complicated. When you say to a provider, hey, you can't do anything to delay or change the quality of service of anybody for any reason, wow, that's tough.
What about the case that those who are for net neutrality, what are they saying?
The technical arguments are really that, hey, you know, all these arguments that Rob made about ambulances and HOV lanes and delaying email, that's just an excuse for you guys not deploying a properly sized network. You know, if you had enough lanes, if you scaled the number of lanes on this highway to the traffic, none of that would be an issue.
But the traffic time changes day by day and time by time, hour by hour.
You are making a very good argument, Virginia. It's hard to know what the traffic's going to be. And also, by the way, these are real companies. This isn't theoretical. We can't start deploying hundreds of millions of dollars worth of infrastructure, you know, to preserve, you know, some very low percentage chance of somebody's packets being dropped, right? These are businesses.
I think of the analogy of, you know, if you're driving a Prius in certain highways in California, or if you're driving a car that is not burning fossil fuels.
Electric car,
you get to go through traffic differently, right? So you are paying a different amount of money. You are driving a different kind of vehicle. It's giving preference to one, which is sort of anti-democratic some level.
You doing that would be against network neutrality. Network neutrality says, hey, you know, if I'm driving a gas guzzler or I'm driving an electric car, we get the same quality of service, right? But I just believe that on the highways and on the internet, there are some intelligent decisions you can make to make the quality service better for everybody. My analogy about Netflix, I think it's perfectly okay to delay or slow down your next door neighbor's gigantic email upload by half a second or two to make sure that Virginia's voice over IP call, her 911 call, or her movie have a great high quality of service.
Well, let's face it. Most people are more concerned about their movie, aren't they?
Exactly. I mean, you know, we need to get those cat videos out, and they have to be reliable, fast, and secure.
They're making the internet work.
That's right.
So, Rob, was that just rehearsal for another fifth grade class presentation?
No, fifth grade class this week. Maybe next week. We'll see.
I'll stand in for the fifth grade.
Thanks, Virginia. Always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much, Rob Fleischman. He is principal engineer at Akamai Technologies and our regular guest for A Series of Tubes.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Sundance Film Festival was once the place for independent films to make their mark. Films made with sustained passion and devotion, like The Guys Next Door, a documentary that follows a gay couple and their close relationship with a friend who carried two of their children as a surrogate.
So many people asked me with Rachel Maria, oh my gosh, do you think it's going to be really hard to give her to them? And do you feel like it's going to be this big loss? But, you know, it wasn't my egg. I never felt any sense of ownership in any way. It was more like, you know, babysitting.
The Guys Next Door is among the films to win awards at another celebration of new films and filmmakers, the Middlebury New Filmmakers Festival. They're going to be screened at Red River Theater in Concord this Saturday, March 11th. The three short films and three features do not have the huge marketing budgets or studio endorsements of winners at the Sundance Film Festival, but are true indie films made by first and second time filmmakers. And we have a pair of these on the line, both of whom are going to be at the screening this Saturday for The Guys Next Door. Ali Humanuk is freelance director and cinematographer and editor. She's taught production at Harvard and at MassArt. She's director, producer, and director of photography for The Guys Next Door. Ali, hello and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Amy Geller is co-director and co-producer of the film. She's worked as a field producer and production manager on projects for A&E, HBO, MTV, CNN, line producer on commercials and shorts, and the PBS docudrama Murder at Harvard. She was also producer for PBS's Love and Other Anxieties series, among other projects. Amy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Okay, so both of you have a long list of great credits. You both worked in film and TV. And Amy, you have directed a feature documentary called For the Love of Movies. This is about American film critics. Now, what brought you two together for this film?
I actually, just to clarify, I produced that film. My husband, Gerald Perry, directed it, but I was very involved creatively as well. What brought us together? Well, Allie and I have worked together on educational projects in the past, and she is an extraordinary direct cinema verite cinematographer, and I have just been a huge fan of her work over the years. And when I came across this story in my alumni magazine, I went to Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, and I read about this incredible thing that Rachel was doing for her gay friends. I contacted Allie, and I said, I don't know what this is, but I want to follow this story. And usually Allie picks it up from here.
This is Allie. I don't know what I was thinking, but I thought Amy was coming to me wanting to make a film about surrogacy. And the documentary films are really hard to make. They're hard to get funded. They take an enormous amount of time. And so they're basically labors of love. And I have tended to make films that are about, I call them character-driven films, because they're about people first, and then subjects come out of that. So when Amy said, do you want to make this film or help me make this film? I said, no. But I'd be happy to come help you get some footage so you have enough footage to cut a trailer. And then when we went to New York, because the entire family was together, and it was the first time we met everybody, and we actually started filming right away. And after the first day of filming, I looked at Amy and I said, hey, you know, if you want to jump off a cliff with me and make a film that's about this family, not just surrogacy, and it's about, you know, we would take a journey with them and not know where we were going, then I'm on board. And I think it turns out that Amy was probably thinking something similar, that she wasn't necessarily thinking making, you know, a film just about surrogacy. But I think it was at that point when we met the families that we sort of looked at each other and realized that we were on the same page about approaching this film that we had no idea where it was going to go.
Well, I think that's true for a lot of documentary filmmakers. And you did follow this family for 3 years. And of course, that's just in the filming part. There's post-production. But give us a little background on the people you follow. Sandro and Eric are the couple who together have two daughters. And also the family of Rachel Segal. She's married to a man named Tony Hurley, three kids, who carried their two daughters using donor eggs. What do you think was her motivation, I guess?
This is Allie speaking. Rachel's motivation and what it was going to be like for her was one of the things that really attracted us to this film, or to following this family, because we couldn't imagine what it would be like to carry a baby for 9 months and then not keep the baby, but to hand it over to the dad. And so we just thought that we were very curious to see how she would respond emotionally. And when we asked Rachel why she was doing it, I think she gave us a couple answers. One was because she thought Eric and Sandra would make great parents, and that being a parent for her had been extremely important, and that it really helped ground her as a person and helped her feel more a part of the world. And I think she also has a very strong sense of needing to give back to the world. Mm. And this was a way she felt like she could do it. And she loves being pregnant. And so she offered to have babies for her friends. And her kids actually say that their mom is happier when she's pregnant. So they were all on board. They loved it.
She's got three kids. She lives in Newton, Massachusetts. Here she is in the film talking to you about, she's on a treadmill, by the way, so you're going to hear some beeps. So you'll hear one of her answers.
I didn't feel sad about not having the baby. I felt sad about the process ending. I'd been a part of this thing that had felt really important and purposeful. And then they were going off to continue this life, and it was sort of like, okay, not much else for me right now.
That is a clip from the film The Guys Next Door. I'm speaking with the two directors and producers, Allie Humanik and Amy Geller. So, You mentioned her kids were on board. What do you think her husband thought of this? He had to be very much a part of.
Yeah, this is Amy. So Tony is an extraordinary person. He really initially was, you know, very, very supportive. And in the movie, he talks about, you know, having to tell his family he comes from a pretty traditional Catholic family, and having to tell his family, not only are we doing this once, but we're doing it again. And there were some concerns that his family had, particularly about the health of Rachel, which is, you know, he says are valid concerns. He just knows Rachel's heart, and Rachel is an incredibly giving person, and this is something that she felt she wanted to give back to her friends and back to the people that she loves, and he is fully supportive of it. And so I think it's a real wonderful thing to see how integrated the entire family is in terms of, you know, birthing these kids. I mean, Rachel literally does it, but everybody, you know, Rachel, Tony, and her three teenage kids are all really involved in kind of creating a circle of love for these two little girls, and that's what they're born into, and it's pretty special.
And there doesn't seem like a lot of that, you know, and a lot of, maybe we've gotten used to this on reality TV or even scripted drama about families, that's, there's conflict, there's sort of drummed up drama. And I guess as filmmakers, people look for that. And how about you as filmmakers? Did you anticipate those kind of moments?
This is Allie speaking. I don't know that we anticipated those kinds of moments. For me, I don't know that they were super important, because I often find that filming everyday events tends to be revelatory, and that we can see things in the everyday that when they're shown in a certain way, when they're put in a film, when they're magnified, we learn a lot about the characters and ourselves, and we can relate to what's happening because it's something that we all do. And so while there's not drama in that, there's self-revelation. And I believe throughout the film, we learn more and more about the characters. And so the drama, if you want to call it that, is sort of the onion unraveling and getting to know the characters and going on a journey with them. So there's not, as you said, drummed up drama, but there's personal exploration. And I think that's actually a real strength of the film.
It does follow them very closely. And I know that's the way a lot, most documentaries are made. But these, you're in their homes, right there with them, and observing how something that Eric says about their own sense of ordinariness. You know, Rachel is defying other people's expectations of how they perceive this situation to be from outside. But they see themselves as remarkably common. Here's Eric.
I mean, it's just shocking how traditional we've become.
They put Sandra in a wig and heels, and we are the most traditional family you can imagine. But it's just not that easy. Two men raising two girls, all the gender stuff, it becomes simultaneously very important and meaningless.
So in some ways, their relationship, although it may look not look so to other people, is really traditional. You know, Eric's out there working in the world, doing brave things. Sandra's at home alone with two kids. So it's not so much about gender roles or gay identity, but family life.
I totally agree. I mean, there is a discussion about gender roles in the film, and I think that's something that, you know, both Eric and Sandro have dealt with in their lives as gay men. Particularly this sort of internalized homophobia around, you know, if we appear to be feminine, then people will think we're gay. And growing up at a time when that just wasn't okay, you know, being in the closet was really important. And so it's been just in their lifetimes alone how public opinion on this issue has changed so radically. It's still changing. And we hope that, you know, this film can show people a wonderful, loving family who also happen to be gay. And what the sort of universal is about how they love and care for their kids and worry about, you know, their kids' futures like all families do. So it's both the ordinary life and sort of at the same time a little bit extraordinary, in part because of Rachel's role and the sort of extended family between Rachel and her family and Eric and Sandro and their family. that's what makes it pretty darn special.
And you as filmmakers travel not just to Portland, Maine, where Eric and Sandro now live, but to Sardinia, where Sandro is originally from. And, you know, there we learn he's never told his family about his sexuality. But we learn that there's a tradition of surrogacy there. That's something I didn't know about. Was that a revelation to you?
That was a huge revelation to us. And the story is that if there's a family that has a lot of children and that there's, you know, a neighbor that the family hasn't been able to have children, then one of the children from the large family is given to the neighbors. People aren't necessarily intentionally having babies for each other, but they're sort of sharing the wealth, you know, as it may be. And that was the case for one of Sandro's aunts. And it's one of those things that wasn't necessarily obvious to put in the film, because it in some ways feels like a tangent. Like, you know, why are we learning about babies being given away? But I think it's a sign that what Rachel is doing and this idea of extended family is not new. And it's done in different places and in different ways. And it's a way of sharing and it's a way of creating family.
I think the way that this film challenges this traditional idea of a nuclear family or look of a nuclear family and ideas of motherhood and fatherhood and biological imperatives, you know, nature versus nurture. Somebody says in the film, I don't think anyone involved in this would have any idea of what it would look like. Did you have any idea on that day that, you know, it clicked with both of you, you were going to jump off the cliff, what this would look like?
This is Amy speaking. You know, I think we came with our own ideas, perhaps, from our own life experiences and our own family, you know, backgrounds. But I think that we, I don't know, Allie, you'd probably, I don't know if you'll agree with me, but I think it really blew my mind in terms of what's possible. And, I mean, this might sound kind of trite, but, you know, love is love no matter how the family is formed. And meeting these people and getting to spend 3 years with them, I mean, we're now continuing to spend time with them because we've really become friends with them as well, mm-hmm. but following their story really, really highlighted that for me and really, I guess, sort of brought home this idea that you can create family in ways that I didn't think was possible. So I learned a lot through the making of the film.
One of the things that surprised me a lot when I was talking to my mother about the film, she said, you know, I would have done that if that had been possible when I was younger. And that really surprised me. But I think some people really enjoy being pregnant. And I don't know, I guess my mother was one of those people. And I think she really admired what Rachel did. And there was something in her that said, wow, you know, I might have done that. And so I wonder if in some way the film might inspire other people to perhaps have a child for their friends. And actually, that never occurred to me until right now that that's one of the things that the film may do. But, you know, I don't know.
And you have taken this out, you know, on the trail, playing festival circuits. It's going to be playing throughout New England. So what has that meant to you as filmmakers? You know, the creation of what you are bringing to the world, this film, presenting their story.
It's been seeing the audience response has been amazing, because you just don't know what people are going to take away from it. And people have had such varied responses. And, you know, it's been interesting, like when an older gay man came up to me who had never wanted to have family, saw this film and felt, you know, very connected to family in a way that he never thought he would, even though he didn't have kids. And Amy, why don't you share what just happened in...
We were just in Missoula, Montana, screening the film at a festival there. And I had the privilege of going to the public high school in downtown Missoula and screening the film for an auditorium full of teenage high school students. And I, you know, was quite nervous because my impression of high school students is the last thing they want to do is sit down and watch a documentary and, you know, in school. But I watched the second half of the film with them, and they were laughing and they were clapping and they were totally engaged, and we had an incredible Q&A after the screening. So I was totally blown away by that.
Right.
And I would love to show the film to high school students and have that and have more of that dialogue, because I think that's really powerful, especially at that fundamental time in their lives.
And people will be able to meet you at the screening in Concord on Saturday. Amy Galler also speaking with Allie Humanuk. co-directors, co-producers, and Ali is the director of photography for the film The Guys Next Door. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
The Guys Next Door is among the films to win awards at the Middlebury New Filmmakers Festival. The films are touring New England and will be screened at Red River Theater in Concord this Saturday. That's March 11th. There's more on the screenings at wordofmouthradio.org. We are all out of time for today, but here's an invitation for those of you who listen to the Moth Radio Hour and think, hey, I could do that. The New Hampshire Institute of Art is looking for people to share their stories on stage on Saturday, April the 8th. I'll be hosting the event, which is free and starts at 2 in the afternoon. It's open to the public and open to traditional storytellers, illustrators, graphic novelists, and creatives working in a wide variety of media, be it professional or amateur. Maybe you don't think that you have a story to tell, and I would suggest otherwise. We all do. You can go to the website at nhia.edu and take a look at some of the prompts. Maybe that'll make you think of something. Stories are our most ancient art form and really connect us to what is human. We know we all need that human connection. So come, share your story. Again, nhia.edu. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Uncanny Valley's David Seste and Poddington Bear. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.